Is there any other time I need to know? We're going to do 20 minutes non-stop, are we?
Oh, we'll do somewhere between 15 minutes and a half hour. We'll just play it by ear.
Excellent.
Ready to start? Great. When you joined Parliament, you were the youngest member in Parliament. What did you do to try to fit in? Did you have trouble fitting in being that young?
No, I think the British as a race are very sympathetic to their young. And I entered the House of Commons at the age of 29. Of course, I was very nervous and very worried about being that young. But no, they treated me like a young son and answered all my questions and helped me. I think I was a very privileged person. I think if you enter at the age of 40, you probably don't get that sort of fatherly treatment. And I was quite happy to be treated as a young son and as the youngest member and loved every moment of it. I had five very happy years.
What are some of the differences in style between the members of Parliament who are from pedigreed families and from a long line of titles and money and those who are more self-made men?
Well, the British Parliament is changing a lot in that way. I was a member of the Conservative Party. 100 years ago, the Conservative Party was only made up of people like Charles Hampton, the character in First Among Equals, who is the son of an earl. But there are many more nowadays, like Simon Kerslake, middle-class boys who fought their way to Oxford or Cambridge, probably got a scholarship, and then worked afterwards and then entered the House of Commons. In fact, if you looked at the House of Commons today, and in particular the Cabinet, there are no people from Eton, which is the sort of aristocratic school in England, in the entire Cabinet, in the Conservative Cabinet, for the first time in the history of Parliament.
You want to venture a guess about why that's happening?
I think Britain is becoming less class conscious. It's still class conscious, of course, and it would be silly to pretend otherwise. But it's less class conscious and more lively to equality. And it is more possible for someone like myself to enter the House of Commons at 29 than it would have been 50 years ago.
I know there's a woman who's the Prime Minister of England, but are there any women in Parliament?
There are 32 women in the House of Commons at the moment. Of course, they're dominated in the sense by the fact that Margaret Thatcher is Prime Minister, and therefore we have a woman running our country and running it very well. But women still are at a disadvantage, to be honest, every bit as much as they are in the United States of America. Because we have one at the top, people imagine women are doing well, but in fact that's not true.
Did you learn when you were in the House of Commons to say things like, hear, hear?
No, I think I learned that in my cradle, my dear.
Really?
Those of us destined for the high cabinet office at an early age do not have to learn that in the House of Commons. Now, I think the traditions of the Commons are rather fun. I always think that, and that's one of the many things I wanted to show the difference in this book, show the difference between the House of Commons and the Senate and Congress. When I wrote The Prodigal Daughter, the story of the first woman president of the United States, and incidentally, Terry, when I travelled around your country with that, your countrymen laughed at me and said, we'll never have a woman president here. And I said, yes, you'll have a woman on the Democratic ticket next time. And they laughed even louder. But of course, it always takes an Englishman to lead you poor colonials back onto the track, show you where we're going. And in many ways, Margaret Thatcher did give the Americans confidence to believe a woman could hold the very highest office in the land. And not by just becoming Prime Minister, which was quite important, but the Falklands. Because men in this country who spend their entire life trying to be macho and proving something always tell you that women could never lead anything because they have periods and they have babies and they have times of life and all these things. Well, I'd like to see any of your American men up against Margaret Thatcher during the Falklands. They'd have eaten for breakfast. A woman is quite capable of becoming top. But I think it is true to say, both in your country and in mine, that unless a woman is totally willing to give up having children, they are not successful in a career because they take off a period in the middle of their life. It may only be 8 or 10 years. But by then, their rivals, men, have established positions and careers, and that is hard to defeat. And until men can have children, that will be remarkably hard to defeat.
You mentioned before some of the conventions of the House of Commons that were fun to learn and enact. As an American, when I hear a broadcast from the British Parliament and I hear everybody going, hear, hear, and muttering loudly in response to whatever it is Margaret Thatcher is saying, it's just hard for me to understand that it's so unlike anything that happens in this country. How did all that come about, all the hear, hears and the muttering?
Well, I think that is merely 1,000 years of history and the way Parliament has been built up. And I've always thought the parliamentary system superior to your system in this one way, because I'm a great admirer of the American Constitution, and indeed a great admirer of the American political system within certain contexts, which I'll go into. But, you see, Watergate could never have happened in Britain. Not because we don't have people who are evil, not because we don't have people who will make mistakes. Of course we do. The amount of evil is pretty equal, I should have thought, per capita in both countries. But the Prime Minister has to go down to the House of Commons and face Parliament twice a week, only for 15 minutes, when she's asked questions. And she has to answer those questions. Now, if Watergate had arisen, she'd have had to go down. She couldn't have hidden in the White House, or in Downing Street in her case. She'd have had to go down, and the members of Parliament would have said, "What about Watergate then, Maggie? What you doing about Watergate?" And she'd have come outside and said to her people, "What's this Watergate business? What are they talking about?" And they'd have explained it to her, and she'd have cleared it up. But because Nixon was hidden in the White House, surrounded by sycophantic people telling him he was the greatest president since Lincoln, he never faced that. And it's a very healthy thing. People hear it on the radio, and they hear Margaret Thatcher being shouted, and here, and shut up, you silly old thing. It's not a bad thing for someone who is leading a country to have to face the rank and file twice a week for 15 minutes, because it stops the type of Watergate.
My guest is novelist and former member of the House of Commons, Geoffrey Archer. His new novel is called First Among Equals. You left Parliament after losing a lot of money in a financial deal that didn't work out. Did you think that your life and career were going to be permanently ruined after that?
Well, said as glibly and bluntly as that, the poor listener might think, why should it? Because he's now become an author. But I was 34 years old. I very foolishly and stupidly invested all the money I'd made in my small company, $250,000. I borrowed another $250,000 and put that together because I thought if I could double it on this particular share that I wanted to invest in, on, I might say, on the advice of a major bank, I would be financially safe for the rest of my life. When the fraud squad visited me to tell me that all my money had been stolen and that I had an overdraft of $1 million and the shares I had in the bank were worthless, I mentioned the $1 million overdraft, Terry, in case anybody listening to this program has been looking at their overdraft recently and been worried about it. I realized I had to leave the House of Commons for two reasons. One, no one would take a Member of Parliament seriously who'd made that financially stupid mistake. And secondly, on a parliamentary salary, it would have taken 142 years to pay it off. Now, I am an ambitious man, but I couldn't see how I would live to 186. So I had to go out and get a job. Now, people don't automatically offer you a job if you're $1 million overdrawn and you've just left the House of Commons. So finding a job wasn't easy. But the one thing they can't stop you doing is writing. And so I sat down and wrote the first book, not a penny more, not a penny less, the story of four men who between them lose $1 million, and one of them, an American at Harvard, who then goes on to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, calls the other three together and says, "I know who's stolen our money. I found out who Mr. Big is." And they say, "So what?" And he says, "We'll steal it back. Not a penny more, not a penny less. Mustn't go over the top, because that would be stealing. They're only allowed to take back from him exactly what he took from them." Now, I wrote that book and handed it in and thought to myself, well, now I must look for a real job. And to my surprise, millions of people bought the book. And it went on and on and on.
Are there any ingredients you intentionally put into your books so that they have immediate resonance with Americans as well as English readers?
No, although I must admit that when I wrote Cain and Abel, I was very conscious of the fact that had I set it in, say, Paris and London, it would not have had the effect in the sales of setting it in Poland and America, because I had to face the fact that Poland and America, in particular America, the greatest nation on earth, was the most exciting country to set a major story in. You're going to write a story about two men, one born with everything, one born with nothing, who only meet once in their life, but their whole life is intertwined and their whole problems are intertwined. Poland and America was the obvious choice. If I'd been born 100 years ago, I would have set it in Paris and London, without any doubt. And in the case of the prodigal daughter, people used to say to me, well, why do you write about the first woman president? I said, well, we've got a prime minister in England. What can I write? How can I write a story of the first woman prime minister? So to write about the prodigal daughter, the first woman president, is far more interesting. But then I found a strange thing. Although that book sold 4 million copies, Prodigal Daughter sold 4 million copies in America, 1,600,000 people bought it in England in the first year. So I suddenly realized that the British were actually fascinated by the American system. So I thought perhaps the time has come to write a book using England as the background and see if the Americans are fascinated by the British system. My publisher said, no, 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 the Americans are an immensely introvert race. They only care about themselves. They're a selfish, stupid lot. They won't be interested. And I said, I don't believe you. I travel all over your country and I'm asked questions about England all the time, about the royal family, about Buckingham Palace, about the House of Commons, about the House of Lords, all the time. I don't believe you. So I sat down and wrote this story about three men from three different backgrounds. One, the son of a lord, but the second son, so he can't go to the Lords. He can't succeed in the Lords. The second one, a middle-class boy who fights his way to Oxford and wins a scholarship and then becomes president of the Oxford Union. And the third one, a boy born above a butcher's shop in Leeds. All of them arrive in the House of Commons on the same day in 1964. All you know is they're all from totally different backgrounds. All three of them want to be prime minister, but only one of them can make it. And you follow the book through their lives and their problems with their wives and everything that goes right and wrong until on the very last page you discover which one of them becomes prime minister. But I used the House of Commons and the House of Lords as the background because the story would be the same wherever you put it in the world. But it gave me the opportunity to show the Americans how our strange political system worked. And the publishers have turned out to be wrong because the book has sold faster than any of my books. And it is obvious the American people are interested, first and foremost, probably in the story, but secondly, in quietly learning about other people's systems and how they differ from yours.
How would you compare the status of being in the House of Commons to the status of being a best-selling author?
Well, if you're talking about really being in the top few most successful authors in the world. I mean, best-selling is a strange word because you can get on the bottom of the bestsellers list, number 15, and you could call yourself a best-selling author, but you don't actually sell a lot of copies. I mean, people might be stunned to know that you can get on to the 15th place on the New York Times bestsellers list selling 25,000 copies. You know, there are 250 million people in this country. 25,000 isn't very much. But to try and answer your question, I loved being a member of parliament. It was a very great privilege. I was a young man and I loved every moment of it. But, of course, that was in Britain only. That didn't happen anywhere else. And now the books have sold all over the world. And so every country in the world have a sort of position or whatever you want to call it. That is terrific fun. I mean, I love coming to America and seeing the book number one on the New York Times list. Who wouldn't? I mean, let's be honest. The status is very different because as a member of parliament, of course, politicians do get a pretty rough time. People are pretty rude to them most of the time or pretty rude about them. Best-selling authors don't get that sort of rudeness. In fact, they get immense kindness and friendship. And that's been fun, traveling all over the world and seeing how the book sells in different countries and what is happening. Oh, yes, it's been wonderful. And it's very different because interviewers aren't saying, yes, but your policy on tax rejuvenation over gas was disgraceful. Would you like to answer that, Senator? You're not facing that the whole time. Which, in a way, I miss because I loved the hurly-burly of the House of Commons. The interviews are much more gentle. Whenever I'm asked that question, I have to admit that I miss the House of Commons. I miss the political life. And I envy those of my colleagues and contemporaries who have now gone on to be members of the cabinet or to positions that give them an opportunity to serve their country properly. Yes, I do.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Terry. Very kind of you.